Good morning, everyone. Before we start, I'll just remind that this afternoon, our dear friend, Elder Sister Sonia Dine, will be giving the Nadkarni Memorial Lecture. She's speaking about Book 2, which she has given a great deal of study to over the last years. She says, we look always at things from the outside, but Sri Aurobindo asks us to look at things from the inside, and that is how she has tried to look at this longest book in Savitri, the Book of the Traveller of the Worlds. She's followed King Asvapati as he mounts the world stair, and that is the title of her talk, Inside the World Stair. I'm sure this is going to be a very, very rewarding presentation. The talk will start at 4 o'clock, and she will end probably around 5 or 5:15. If people are coming from Pondi, there are buses from behind the ashram leaving from 2:30 onwards, and some light refreshments will be available here before the talk. And then I can remind you that tomorrow morning we are starting the screening of our Round the World Savitri Parayan, which many of you have participated in. When we put all the recordings together, we found that the duration of the Parayan is less than expected. We'd estimated about 48 hours. It's coming to about 35. So, because the editing and projecting team have been working day and night for the last week, we decided to make things a little easier for them. We will start the screening at 6 a.m. instead of 3 a.m. as originally announced. We have published a kind of timetable of the journey. But this morning we discovered, our friend in Netherlands discovered that there are some mistakes in that, so we'll be reissuing it probably tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I hope we'll have the correct version we can distribute here and we can email out to everyone. On the 21st, on Mother's birthday, at 10:30 in the morning, the Divine Flowers exhibition will be opened, and that will run until 28th, Auroville's birthday, at 5 p.m. So those preparations are going on now. We hope they'll be fully ready to open at 10:30 on Wednesday. We think it'll be about 4:30 or 5 in the afternoon, on Tuesday afternoon. Sorry?
We might have a gathering here about 4:30
Of course, everybody's welcome to drop in and out at their convenience during the screening. We welcome you all, and perhaps we'll have a good turnout for the closing hours or so. I think the last a couple of hours are all read, all the passages are read by Aurobillians. We start in Book 4, Book 10, Canto 4, the Auroville readings start. So that's quite a rich program for us in the days ahead. You see, it will be available, the whole sequence will be available via a link which we have publicized. It's on our posters. At the same time as we start to screen it here, that link will be activated and you can watch it from wherever you are in the world, on your on internet, on your screen, wherever. Also, at this point, perhaps I can say that we are aware of many imperfections in this version, and we don't consider it the final version. We're contemplating working on making it more perfect and perhaps replaying for Sri Aurobindo's birthday. But you were asking about people getting their clips. Yes, we'll be sending out information about this. It will be possible. It will be some work. At this busy time, we can't promise exactly when, but perhaps in March sometime we will be able to send you your clips. You can pick up on a flash drive, or we can send by Dropbox. So let's now turn to the reason for it all. We are reading in Book 2, Canto 3, The Glory and the Fall of Life. And I think we stopped on page 118 at the break, but perhaps we read to the next two sections, at least the first section.
No, we read through.
We read through the whole canto?
No, we read through up to page number 122 and we stopped.
So today we are going to start studying on page 118 at the break. First, I will read the last sentence of the first section. When King Aswapati entered, when he left the realm of subtle matter and entered the realm of life, it says, if he enters it on the level that we live on, a world of doubt and uncertainty, where we don't know what truth and beauty are, and in which life is driven by irrational impulses. He says, trying to drain all experience. The spirit of life seems to have no moral values. It is only variety of experience which moves it. And yet, says Sri Aurobindo, yet pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. Her moods are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are her divine right. And endless bliss is her eternal home. We're on page 118 at the break, and we'll read on from there.
Native right.
Her native.
What is divine?
It's also
beauty and happiness are her native right. Yes, her right by birth, because she has a divine birth. And I think I mentioned last time that I find this is one of the most important and unique aspects of Sri Aurobindo's vision and teaching. Unlike other spiritual teachers and paths, he doesn't tell us to turn away from life in order to achieve liberation. It is life itself that has to be liberated. Life here in the material world must become divine. And that can only be done, as Mother has said in one of her messages to Auroville, that it's by defining the divine in everyday life that can come about. Would everybody please mute their phones? Don.
I've been in and out, and therefore I just want to confirm that she
is life, the spirit of life, the goddess of life. Luba, would you read?
Greece now revealed its antique face of joy, a subtle disclosure to the heart of grief, tempting it to endure and love and hope. Even in changing worlds bereft of peace, in an air wrapped with sorrow and despair, and while his feet trod on the soul unsafe, he saw the image of a happier state. In an architecture of hierarchical space, circling and mounting towards creation's doors, at a blue height which never was too high. for one communion between body and soul, as far as heaven, as near as salt and hope, glimmer the kingdom of a briefness life. Above him, in a new celestial world, other than the heavens beheld by modern eyes, as on a threaded ceiling of the gods, an archipelago of laughter and fire, long stars apart in a rippled sea of sky.
Thank you. So the passage begins with the word this. This is the eternal home of life, eternal home of bliss. And that world revealed its face, its antique face of joy to King Aswapati. I love very much this use of the word antique here. With antiques, of course, we think of furniture and objects that are more than 100 years old, that have some special value. When Sri Aurobindo uses it, he uses it in a different sense. And I think it's two suggestions. One is that it's very, 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 very old. It's original. It's antique face of joy, that the face that the home of life, the origin of life, has always had. But it also reminds me of certain ancient statues from Southeast Asia, from Greece, which have a very, very special smile. Sri Aurobindo has written about it in his book on his chapters on Indian art. The way that the old masters somehow were in contact with that higher realm, and they knew how to depict it and share it with us, this blissful smile, the antique face of joy. So that the sight of that home and that face is for King Aswapati a sudden disclosure. It comes like a revelation to the heart of grief. He's very, very aware of all the grief and trouble and imperfection of our world. But by this smile, all that heart of grief is tempted to endure and long and hope. There he is in that changing world, that changeful world of life as we know it, in these worlds bereft of peace, where they have no peace, they are missing it, in its air, which is wrecked, tortured with sorrow and with fear. And while his feet are still standing on this shaking ground, this quaking earth that he described in the previous canto, Aswapati sees the image of a happier state. And that happier state is imaged in the next lines. The poet writes about an architecture of hieratic space, sacred space, and arranged in order, in hierarchies, in tiers. He sees these kingdoms of a griefless life. That architecture is circling and mounting towards the very highest levels of creation. But they are not up at the very highest levels. They are at a blue height, but that height is not too high to mean that there can't be any communication between the soul and the body, a warm communication. But nevertheless, these worlds seem as far away from us as heaven, but still as close to us as thought and hope, these glimmering the kingdom of a griefless life. It's above him in a new celestial vault, not the sky that we see when we look out into space, other than the heavens beheld by our physical eyes. It looks as if it's a kind of ceiling that's been decorated with very intricate woodwork and painting, carved and painted. There is a fretted ceiling that's beautifully decorated, an archipelago of laughter and fire. An archipelago is a series of islands. So these islands are separated, it says, like stars apart in a rippled sea of sky, as if the sky is a sea and those islands of joy are stars in it. And he describes some of those islands. They look perhaps like some of the images we see now from the Hubble telescope. Towered spirals, magic rings of vivid hues, wonderful colors, and gleaming spheres of strange felicity floated through distance like a symbol world. That is the image that he is seeing of the origin of life. Sorry?
Strange felicity.
One, I suppose, that is unfamiliar.
And yet welcome and warming.
Yes. And even as if we have been thinking and hoping of it, you know, that fulfillment of life, it's as if we are all carrying a dream of that within us and we recognize it. But nevertheless, it's strange and surprising when it actually comes. So all these things are floating through distance like a symbol world, which he's seeing from this lower life realm. One more?
On the trouble and the toil they could not share, on the unhappiness they could not aid, impervious to life's suffering, struggle, grief, untarnished by its anger, gloom, and hate, unmoved, untouched, look down, great vision planes, blissful forever in their timeless light, absorbed in their own beauty and content, of their immortal gladness they live sure, apart in their self-glory plunge, remote, burning they swam in a vague, lucent haze, an everlasting refuge of green light, a nebula of the splendors of the gods, made the musings of eternity. Almost unbelievable by human faith, hardly they seemed the stuff of things that are.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about this passage?
I'd like to make a comment, which is that to me it seems a decision of the very spiritual heights that the ancient Indian spirituality wished to attain to. And it's the pulling back from life's surface and all of its troubles that gives that sense.
Yes, life as it is on its surface is too difficult, but something is longing for those worlds of strange felicity.
Of the immortal gladness. Gladness is a degree of happiness little less, no? So
but gladness can be a continuous state. Maybe rapture or ecstasy or... of course, bliss, if we reach high enough, that's also a continuous thing. But there's something calm and even ordinary about gladness.
It's interesting that this description of the kingdom of a griefless life Shrivinda also describes in terms of a symbol world. And,
yes.
If one reads in the Hour of God, some of those essays there, it makes it very clear that for Shrivinda this whole manifestation is nothing but a symbol world. Nothing but a representation of the divine reality. So I'm wondering why
this is an image.
To this particular kingdom of the griefless life in this particular instance.
He's suggesting
that it's not entirely real.
It's not entirely real. It's not entirely real because it's not a material world. But he says it allows a connection, a communion with body, between body and soul.
My understanding is that Sri Aurobindo also considers the material
actually,
world,
all these, world. All these worlds which Aswapati is going to travel through in these 15 cantos, they are all symbol worlds. Just as at the end of the poem, the world Savitri passes through in her mission, her quest to save the soul of Satyavan. They are all symbol worlds. But somewhere he says that the symbol carries within it the power of its essence, of what it symbolizes, the truth that it stands for. But here, Aswapati is still in our world, the life quality of our world, but he's being shown this image of that symbol world of griefless life, which it will take him a long time to reach. Now we are in Canto 3. He reaches it only in Canto 9.
Is he going through meditation to these worlds, or how is he reaching this world?
Yes, it's a good question, Prasad. We don't exactly know in which state he is. It must be a state of concentration, aspiration, and in that state, all these things are revealed to him, systematically, in order. And his body seems to participate in this. He must be in a subtle body, or in his subtle being, but he hasn't lost touch with the physical yet. Because these worlds are actually in us. He told us that, no? Earlier on in Book 2, Canto 1, I think. And there's a beautiful chapter in his book on the Vedas. It's called The Doctrine of the Mystics. He says, where are these worlds? They are in us. They're arranged in this hierarchy within us. And it's because they're within us and because they constitute our psychology that it is possible for us to mount from one level to another, as Aswapati is depicted doing here in books 2 and 3. But we have to say he's alone on this journey. It's not a world with, of course, he encounters other beings. He can see them and become aware of them and their nature. But he's uncompanioned on this journey. Shall we go on? Marie-Ange, will you read?
As to energy, television, glass, outline some magnifying inner eyes, they shone like images, one coming far seen, too high and glass for mortal leaves, and for mortal leaves seal. But near and real, to the longing heart, and the body's passionate thought and sense are the hidden kingdoms of the attitude. In some close unattained realm, which yet we feel, immune from the harsh clutch of death and time, escaping the search of soul and desire, in blind, enchanted states, peripheries, forever wallowing in bliss delight. In dreams and trance and muse before eyes, across a circle of visions in a field, wide, rapturous landscape fleeting from the sight, the figures of the perfect kingdom pass, and behind them leave a shining memory's trail.
Thank you. In these lines and the next lines to the break, it's as if Sri Aurobindo is answering your question, sir. He's conveying to us the relationship between the symbol worlds and ourselves, and this particular symbol world and our experience. Aswapati sees them as if he's watching through a telescope and a television at the same time. A telescope that brings these images near and magnify them to the inner eye of consciousness. They're shining there like images thrown from a far scene. A scene that is too high and glad for our physical eyes to catch hold of, but it's very near and real to the longing heart and to the body's passionate thought and sense. There's something in the body which divines the existence of the possibilities of this happiness. These are the hidden kingdoms of beatitude. They are too high and glad for our physical eyes to see, but they are very near and real to our longing hearts, which want us to be able to experience them also in living reality, in the physical world, in the material world. I think this was written in the late 30s, and perhaps television was already, the principle of television perhaps was known, but I think he seized hold of this useful word to express an experience which he had long before. So far as we know, I don't think he ever saw an actual physical television.
No, this is not the television as we know. Television, the word means statement, far distance, view for far distance. Basically, this is like a binocular view.
That means television.
So through a telescope or transmitted to us by a telephone, television, we can.
David means far.
And his realm is close to us. We haven't reached it. It's unattained, but it is close to us. We feel it, and that realm where it is immune from death and time, that harsh clutch which we are in the grip of. And yet they're far enough away to escape the search of sorrow and desire. Those kingdoms live in bright, enchanted, safe peripheries. Forever wallowing in bliss they lie. Wallowing, it's really a nice image in one word. No? It's what elephants do in the river, no? And hippopotamuses and pigs. Oh, they wallow. They wallow in the mud. But these worlds are wallowing in bliss forever. It's very nice how he uses this rather crude wallowing.
Are we looking at the subtle worlds from which Mother was able to see? Auroville is waiting to manifest?
I think so, yes. Perhaps she saw Auroville from the subtle physical realm. But there's a hierarchy of these subtle worlds, and definitely she not only saw Auroville, she in 1916 or something like that, she saw the freedom of India.
Yes.
And so she said it's absolutely sure, it's destined to happen. And of course some things we see in the subtle world are not so firmly destined as that. They are possibilities which may or may not be realized.
He said it will be without violence, the British will themselves leave, the world situation will become better.
Yes, if they had listened to Sri Aurobindo, perhaps there would have been less violence than actually happened. So we experience these worlds if we have the capacity of subtle vision. Rapturous landscapes fleeing from the sight, the figures of the perfect kingdom pass. We may see images of them in dream and trance and muse, and behind them they leave a shining memory's trail. The memory itself is a kind of path leading us inward.
It could also be the imagination of authors.
Of what?
Authors, artists.
Yes, of course. Would you read the next lines, please, Don?
Okay. Imagine scenes of great eternal worlds, dream courts of sense. They touch our hearts with their depths. Unreal seeming, yet more real than life. Happier than happiness, truer than things true. If dreams these were, or captured images, dream's truth made false earth's vain reality. In a swift, eternal moment, fixed there with forever recalled, longing eyes, calm heavens of imperishable light, illumined continents of violet peace, oceans and rivers of the mirth of God, and griefless countries under purple sun. Mm. Oh my God.
These were the lines which Sunilda has captured in the beautiful music we heard.
Violet,
it's one of the colors of the vital, the life being.
You know, Shraddha, when mother saw Auroville as if the peacock spread its wings, and she said, pity that I can't capture this image with the photograph, I cannot photograph this one. And there you have the purple color and the violet color in peacock's wings.
Mm-hmm. Some painter has to paint this.
That's what perhaps true artists are always trying to do, you know, to catch these images of the subtle worlds. He says they may be only imagined scenes, but they may also be great eternal worlds. They may be just caught in dream, or it may even become real to the senses, but whichever way it is, they touch our hearts with their depths. They seem unreal because they don't belong to our material world, which we experience as the main reality, and yet they are more real than life, than the life we know here. They are happier than our happiness, truer than things true. So if dreams these were, or captured images, things that have really been seen, dream's truth made false earth's vain realities. When we insist that this is the only reality, these dreams, these images are so real and so powerful that they contradict that conviction that only this is real. We catch them perhaps in a fixed eternal moment or in a swift eternal moment, but they remain with us, since they are always there, or they come back to us, ever recalled, they come back again and again to the eyes of our longing eyes of our memory, these calm heavens of imperishable light, illumined continents of violet peace, oceans and rivers of the mirth of God, of God's laughter, and griefless countries under purple sun. In Shobindo's correspondence about Savitri, there's an exchange between him and Amal Kiran about these purple suns. Amal reminded Sri Aurobindo that there's an image like this in Virgil's Aeneid. And Sri Aurobindo said, yes, to the Romans, these vital heavens with their purple suns, they were the only heavens. They didn't know of any higher heavens. But he said, but I've taken the inspiration of Virgil's line to add a needed line here. So this griefless countries under purple suns. Baudelaire has...
Baudelaire,
le soleil... Le pauvre.
Le soleil sous les cieux. It is the same.
Yes. Well, of course, many people have read Virgil.
Yes, of course.
And, but it's a beautiful image anyway. Wonderful. Capturing a very specific level of happiness, of delight. In the color spectra or in symbolism? Purple, if I'm correct, if there's artists here who know better, purple has more red in it, and violet has more blue. And of course, red and purple, they have their own symbolic effects and meanings. Of course, also the word purple has a specific connotation of its own. Purple, of course, it's a color, and it's a color that was found or made by the Phoenicians in the Eastern Mediterranean. They found a shellfish, and they could extract from this fish a dye, which they used to dye cloth. And we heard from an Italian visitor, lady who had a great knowledge of history, that purple cloth, which was so much valued that only in ancient Rome, only the imperial family were allowed to wear clothes made of it. It wasn't only this lovely purple dye, it was interwoven with threads of gold. So it was very shiny and brilliant. So that's why the suns are purple, you know? They have this brilliant, shining quality.
I want to say something about purple. It comes to me as Jimi Hendrix.
Louder.
Jimi Hendrix and Purple Haze, the song, it was really...
Most of us won't know it. So what's the quality of the song?
You had a vision.
Yes, a purple haze.
Like a
kind of mist.
Or yeah. A mist, but it was a really strong song. Anyway, so that was the title of the song.
So, shall we read on? Vikas?
This, once a star of bright revoked idea, or imagination's comet trail, a dream, took now a close reality. The gulf between green truth, earth fact, was crossed. The wonder worlds of life were dreams no more. His vision made all they unveiled its own. Their scenes, their happenings, met his eyes and heart and smote them with pure loveliness and bliss. The breathless summit region drew his gaze, whose boundaries jutted into a sky of self and dipped towards a strange ethereal base. The quintessence glowed of life's supreme delight. On a spiritual and mysterious peak, only a miracle's high transfiguring line divided life from the formless infinite and sheltered time against eternity.
Thank you. So these are all inner experiences, psychological experiences, which King Aswapati is having. And the first sentence here expresses a transition. First he sees an image of those kingdoms of the griefless life. So then it's a star of bright remote idea, and it might only be a comet trail of dream behind some imagination. But in his experience, this gulf between dream truth and earth fact gets crossed, bridge. These wonder worlds of life were dreams no more. His vision, his power of inner vision, made all they unveiled its own. He's really seeing and living these experiences. So the scenes and happenings of those worlds met his eyes and his heart and smote them powerfully with pure loveliness and bliss. It's an experience by identification. And then he looks higher than those worlds, up to their tops, to a breathless summit region of very rarefied state, and the boundaries of that, like the outlines of mountains against the sky, jutted into a sky which represents the one, the self of all. And these mountains seem to dip down towards a strange ethereal base, not a rocky hard base, but a misty ethereal base. And he sees the glow of the quintessence, the ultimate essence of life's supreme delight. And there, as if on the very highest peak, it's a spiritual, mysterious peak, there's just this thin line, he says, a miracle's high, transfiguring line divides life from the formless infinite. These are not distant states. The highest levels of life are very close to the transcendent. He makes that point again later on in the poem. But here he's seeing this closeness, that there's only this faint little line, you know, dividing life from the formless infinite, sheltering time, our world of time and space, against infinity and eternity.
By definition, sheltered time against eternity takes us back to time as being something that is cut up. The very earliest definition of time, I heard this on BBC, so it can't be true. The earliest definition of time was cutting up
into minutes and seconds and moments and hours.
And it seems to be implied here that time is sheltered against eternity.
Our world of material manifestation, what we live in, including all the subtle worlds, which also have forms and atmospheres. What separates them from the transcendent state is this transfiguring line which gives rise to space as the one consciousness objectifies itself in distance and in time, with this succession of moments which seems to be unidirectional, which doesn't or the other direction, and of multiplicity. The one is divided up into uncountable myriads of selves, of individual selves. Disaggregated, gets more and more and more disaggregated, so that when the universe manifests, there's only these tiny, tiny little subatomic particles, or even less than that, some kind of little specks of existence. He will describe all this process later in the poem. So yes, space and time, these are the individuality, disaggregation, these are the starting conditions for this world we live in. And then the adventure, the fun, seems to be to, out of all this, to bring everything back to a oneness which is conscious of its differences. I can't resist reading in Canto, Book 1, Canto 5, page 88, after the break, line 524. This is the vision King Aswapati has seen, introducing him to this hierarchy of worlds, ascending and descending twixt life's poles. The serried kingdoms of the graded law plunged from the everlasting into time. Then, glad of a glory of multitudinous mind and rich with life's adventure and delight and packed with the beauty of matters, shapes and hues, climbed back from time into undying self, up a golden ladder, carrying the soul, tying with diamond threads the spirit's extremes. In this drop from consciousness to consciousness, each leaned on the occult inconscience power, the fountain of its needed ignorance, archmason of the limits by which it lives. In this soar from consciousness to consciousness, each lifted tops to that from which it came, origin of all that it had ever been, and home of all that it could still become. The passage goes on, but it's a wonderful key to understanding something of Shobindo's vision of the evolutionary unit. So we stopped at the bottom of page 120, line 171. Let's go on from there. Norman, you'll read.
Out of that fullness, though, time is his shapes. The eternal's quiet holds the cosmic act. The protean images of the world force have drawn the strength to be, the will to love, from the deep ocean of dynamic peace. Inverting the spirit's apex towards life, she spends the plastic liberties of the world to cast in acts the dreams of her caprice. His wisdom's call steadies a careless feet. He props her down upon a rigid base. His timeless, still immutability must standardize a creation's miracle. Out of the void's unseeing energies, inventing the scene of a concrete universe, by his thought she has fixed its paces and its blind acts. She sees by flashes in his all-knowing light.
Thank you.
At her will.
No, we'll stop sorry. There. No, no, thank you. Anything to share or act ask about this?
Would you speak about this phrase, inverting the spirit's apex towards life?
Mm. The apex is the highest point. No? So it's as if he's turned the highest point downwards. Mm.
Protean.
It refers to a figure in Greek mythology who was a shape changer. He could never be caught hold of because he could always change his shape. I think he's connected with one of the labors of Hercules. Mm-hmm. So protean, it means shape shifting. Protean images of world force. No, things are like this in this particular shape for a time, and then they dissolve and take on another shape or become part of another shape. It's always changing.
It's in the Odyssey.
It's in the Odyssey, yes. Thank you. So all those shape shiftings have drawn the strength to be, to exist, and the will to even endure from this deep ocean of dynamic peace, of the formless, of the formless, infinite and eternal. So what life does, what the world force, the creative force does, is that she inverts the spirit's apex, its very highest transcendent level, down towards life. And she makes use of these liberties of the one in a plastic way, making shapes, and to cast in acts, in living actions, the dreams of her caprice. The world force is full of these dreams and ideas of wonderful possibilities, and it's by not keeping them up there just in consciousness, but pointing them down towards life, towards mind and life and matter, that she makes them real to us in some way.
He says her caprice, so it's very arbitrary on kind of her mood.
Yes.
She creates.
Yes, out of, for fun.
Yeah, for fun.
For delight. Yes. But his wisdom's call, the call of the one, the self, steadies her careless feet. He keeps her within certain limits, but he also gives her a base. This is also a kind of allusion to the image of Lord Shiva, who lets Kali, the time force, dance his breast. He gives her something to dance on. He props her dance upon a rigid base. His timeless, still immutability, his changelessness, has to standardize her creation's miracle. He gives some kind of limits and criteria. Out of the voids, emptiness, unseeing energies, unconscious energies, she invents a scene of a concrete universe, this universe we live in that we can touch. By his thought, she has fixed its paces, its steps, and in its blind acts, in all its unconscious, instinctive, automatic movements, she sees by flashes, not fully conscious, but now and then by flashes of his all-knowing light.
I'm seeing in these lines, surely they're symbol.
Yes. We can see it more or less on the page. Yes, yes. Yes. Shall we read one more sentence, Patricia?
At her will, the inscrutable supermind leans down to guide her force that feels but cannot know. Its breath of power controls her restless seas, and life obeys the governing idea. At her will, led by luminous immanence, the hazardous experimenting mind pushes its way through obscure possibles mid chance formations of an unknowing world. Our human ignorance moves towards the truth that nescience may become omniscient. Transmuted instincts shape to divine thoughts. Thoughts house infallible immortal sight, and nature climb towards God's
action. Thank you. I think we can stop there for today. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.